Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hi everyone, I'm Ian Flux. Been very lucky to race for 49 years, been involved with Formula One and many other forms of all angles of motorsport.
The Driven Chat podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Hello, I'm John Markar and welcome to this week's Driven Chat podcast.
I'm Miles Lacey.
And also welcome to this week's... Ladies and gentlemen, dear listeners, boys and girls, whoever you are, we thought we'd say a very quick hello ahead of this week's episode, which, as you heard from there in the introduction, is with the wonderful racing driver and a bit of a character, Mr. Ian Flux. Now, Ian is joining us this week because he's written a book, and it's a very good book. It's a very interesting book. It's very animated and includes lots of interesting stories about his career and things outside his career as well. The book is called For Flux's Sake. His surname is Flux. So yes, For Flux's Sake. And you'll note that that's a particularly good play on words, very close to some colourful language. And I thought I'd mention here, whilst we are going to do our best to do a bit of editing in this, this is certainly going to be a podcast that's going to be perhaps a little raw for little ears, shall we say. So yes. If you are listening, perhaps in the car with the family, then maybe now is the time to just cancel this one and perhaps just reserve it for when the younger ears aren't around. That is, I assume, if you don't want to have lots of questions like, what does he mean by that, Daddy?
Yeah.
Because there's going to be a few of those, I imagine. But also, I thought it was important beforehand, before we get that little disclaimer in, it's important that we set the scene to explain who Ian is and what he's been doing. So, Miles, this is effectively your guest. You've very kindly arranged Ian to come in to see us today. So why don't you give us a quick overview of who Ian is, what he's been doing, and what makes him so significant in the racing world.
Rightly so, yeah. So Ian Flux is maybe a name that you've heard of, possibly not, but certainly within motorsport circles, if you mention the name Ian Flux, most people will shiver or run away because they'll go, oh no, because they often most people in the industry have probably got a story that shared with him they might be slightly embarrassed about. However, Ian is a much loved racing driver. His career spanned over 40 years, starting in 1972, racing for nearly 50 years, which is a hell of an achievement. In that time, 5 national championships in Britain, including Formula V and British GT. And as he will tell us later on in the podcast, drove an enormous variety of cars, over 600 in fact, from open wheelers to sports cars, sedans and GTs, all the way up to Formula One. And pretty much if it's got wheels, it seems like he's had a go in it at some point. So that is Mr. Ian Flux. And best of luck with the podcast.
Absolutely. I remind you again, if you have got young listeners anywhere near, now is the time to just pop this onto the reserve list for later. It's not going to be suitable for younger ears. As I say, we've tried to edit it to be clean, but there might be a few swear words that have slipped through, and there are certainly going to be a number of stories that are going to be quite difficult to explain to the innocent minds of our children.
Don't listen to it whilst you're in church, because the water will start boiling.
That's also very, very true. But you are going to enjoy this. So do enjoy. Listener discretion is advised, and yes, enjoy the episode.
The Driven Chat Podcast.
So, Ian, firstly, thank you for joining us. One of the things that I like to do, I do this with almost every guest that we have that comes in, is just to kind of help our listener build up a picture of who you are and how you got to where you are. I like exploring the very sort of early memories that you might have that's essentially got you to where you are today. So do you have like a core memory as far back as you can think, be that as a child or even as a toddler, that might be that little light bulb moment that ultimately got you in racing cars and got you to where you are now?
I've got two. One as a 6-year-old and one as a 17-year-old.
Perfect.
6-year-old, I had no idea. We lived on a farm, and when I came home from school on my 6th birthday, there was a go-kart and it was mine. And luckily we had about a mile and a half of tarmac through the farm, and I went up and down on that go-kart thousands and thousands of times. Absolutely loved it. When I was 17, I really didn't have a clue what I wanted to do. I was racing at that point, but no idea what I wanted to do with my life. I got flung out of college for being an idiot, and the guy who owned the garage suggested it wasn't a good idea that he could keep me on at the garage. So he had a friend who had a Formula One racing team, which was then three people. I was the fourth member, not 600. So we actually all knew each other. And I was there on my third day, and it was a light bulb moment. I just thought, this is what I want to do. So that's my two memories.
Brilliant stuff. Brilliant memories. I love hearing those stories because it does help build up that picture of why and how and where journeys began, and it's always fascinating to hear where it all started. I guess we should definitely reference this book, and I find it one of the things that was really interesting is just before we hit record, you mentioned that there was a whole list of stories and anecdotes that ended up on the cutting room floor that perhaps didn't make it into the book for various reasons, and I hope we get to explore some of those.
Well, let's hope so.
But I thought a good starter, Miles has got the book in front of him. He's got the blurb on the back. So, Miles, if you'd like to do your best voiceover voice and read that blurb.
Well, indeed I will. And what I would say is, to preface the preface, when the news that Mr. Ian Flux was going to be writing a book, word spread across the industry that this was happening, and lots of people went, oh dear, I hope I'm included in it, but in the most sanitary manner.
Yeah, there was a lot of people shitting themselves.
So many people I know went, and I'd never met you.
Yeah,
I'd heard of you, I'd never met you. So many friends went, Ian's writing a book. I'm quite nervous about that.
They're all the guilty people.
All the guilty people, for sure.
What we wanted to do at the back of the book, but the publishers decided not to, was all those people, the aforementioned people you're on about.
Yeah.
Just to do a list with nothing, just to list the names.
Nice.
And so I could say, oh, you're in the book. And they're going, no. And then just see they're like a class list.
They're all looking to possibly escape the country.
Yeah. Or looking for a lawyer.
So the image on the front's fantastic. The book's called For Flux Sake, which is a fantastic play on words. And the image on the cover is you sat on the tyre of a
Formula One car
with a can of beer in your hand.
And a fag.
And it reads, beers, fags and opposite lock. That's which good. I think is, if we needed three words to best describe your life,
yeah,
clearly they're the three that we're going to use.
That is a wonderful photo because it was such an emotional day for me. That's the car I worked on as a 19-year-old boy at Graham Hills. And that was the car that had been testing when the accident happened in November 1975, when they were all killed on Graham's plane.
Yes.
The car was obviously all built. And then to celebrate, remember 30 years on, I got to drive that car at Dijon. And that was the shot that was directly I got out of the car. That's why my helmet's on the front wing after I've finished having my 10 laps in it.
That's fantastic.
And I had tears in my eyes, I can assure you.
Yeah, all made better by having a can of beer. So I shall quickly, I'll quickly read what's on the back here. So contrary to popular belief, Fluxy, as you're affectionately known, did not enter the world on full opposite lock, nor did he have a cigarette in one hand and a pint in the other. Destined to race, he never got the biggest breaks, but he did become one of the one of motorsport's most colourful and best loved characters. Someone who has always lived life to the full. His autobiography tells it how it was, covering not only the highs, including five championship titles, but also the many setbacks. Along the way, we laugh with him about much of it, particularly the pranks, but also learn about some dark times that he never previously divulged. This is a very kind. This is a very different kind of driver's memoir.
Isn't that wonderful?
Isn't it? Isn't it? I feel like I want to rip the packaging off it now and have a good go at it.
You can for 25 quid.
And I would add as well that the picture of you on the back is you wearing some overalls and flipping the bird at the camera.
Yeah, and that we won Nagaro, the world sports car. That's winning the last ever world sports car race.
Brilliant.
In 2003.
Brilliant.
Well, if there was any some prose or copy to drag you into reading a book, then I think maybe that is it.
Yeah, for sure. So you alluded there in your description of that particular photograph on the front cover there, which I'd just like to explore a little bit. So what I'd be writing then in saying that your entry into the world of motorsport was on the technician side rather than the driving side, is that right?
No, I'd started racing Formula 6 as a 13-year-old.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And then progressed when I passed my driving test at 17 to Formula V.
Yeah.
So I was already racing.
Got it.
But only, obviously, at club level.
Yeah.
At that period. And perfect. The job just aligned with what... You know, finding out what I actually wanted to do. I certainly didn't want to be a bloody apprentice mechanic in a BMC garage because I used to cause too much havoc. Still do, apparently.
So I suppose a quick place to start. You gave us the intro, but, you know, was the aspiration from a young age to become a racing driver?
Yes. I can remember clearly going to Brands Grand Prix circuit, and I think it was 1966 and I'd be 10, we were watching Jim Clark go up onto the Grand Prix loop off the club circuit through South Bank, as it was called then.
Yeah.
And the front wheel coming off of Jim Clark's Cortina. And I can remember clearly saying to Dad, that's what I'm going to do.
Brilliant.
And he looked at me and went, really?
Yeah.
That's at least he said that and, oh, no, you're not.
Yeah, no, Dad was very, very, very supportive.
Brilliant.
I wouldn't be sitting here today if it wasn't for my mum and dad in the early years paying for my karting and early racing. So, you know, there was always encouragement to do it. But instantly I got to Formula 3, there was absolutely no support because they weren't in that ballpark of
course,
money.
Yeah, of course. Well, as we were just quickly talking before we started recording, we were talking about, you know, our respective racing careers and whatnot and how different it is, so significantly different to, of course, when you started versus where we are now.
Yeah.
But the thing I find fascinating is that you've been racing for 49 years.
Yeah.
And you said only this year is the first year you haven't renewed your race licence.
Yeah, second year.
Second year.
But I retired at the start of 2019.
Sure.
From racing, not from having a go.
Yeah.
But, you know, if somebody said, would you like a few laps in that lovely Ferrari? I'm not going to say, no, I've retired. But absolutely no racing. And that once I said no, that was the end of it.
So 50 years, you know, we can consider that you've probably seen quite a few things during that time. Is there anything that sticks out in your early career that was quite formative into, you know, what was essentially a very fantastic racing career?
Yeah, Piccadilly toilets. And that stuck out quite a lot.
Really?
Yeah, I was a rent boy.
Oh, God. Yeah, you're not joking, are you?
No. I'd managed to cover it up for years, but I got caught in a police sting in Piccadilly toilets. and had to go to Marylebone Magistrates Court for soliciting. And I go to the court and I'm looking down the list, and there was a tap on the shoulder, and Tim Lee Davey, who used to race, he made his name. Do you remember the Big Time programme in the 70s? And Sheena Easton was the first big time person.
Yeah. Right.
And obviously working 9 to 5 and all that. And the following week, it was Tim being a racing driver. But Tim also trained to be a lawyer.
Uh-huh.
So he had something to fall back on.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I'm at Marylebone Magistrates Court and there's a tap on the shoulder. Oh, hello, Tim. And he said, oh, what are you here for, Fluxy? I said, oh, seeding. And he said, oh, I'll come in and help you. I'll get you fine reduced or something. And he said, well, you're in this court here. It says soliciting. That's not speeding. So obviously that's when the cover was all blown. Nah. So I got away with it for years, but then it all came out.
Wow.
Jesus Christ.
Well, there we go. I'm going to add that to my list of things I didn't expect to hear in this podcast.
I was normally trying to get 250 quid a week, which would buy the tyres for the weekend. So when you were saying about the price of your tyres, to get $3,000 a week, you're going to have some customers.
Yeah. Oh, God. Right. I can feel the DMs coming in already.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I'm going to get in so much pain for this. Anyway, this is already a great start. You're absolutely right. I'm very, very fortunate that I don't have to do any soliciting for tyres these days.
Yeah, you're a good-looking boy.
Get me out of here.
Yeah, if I was a bit younger.
Oh, God. Has this got an ejector seat attached to it? Jesus Christ. Well, then we're off to a flying start there, Ian. Well, that is not a traditional route into motorsport.
No, it was a supportive route. I'd done two really good seasons and full budget of Formula 3 in 76 and 77.
Yeah.
And then I lost my sponsor and I had a few people helping me out to do 78. And I met this guy who was a butler for a mate of mine who was doing Sports 2000. And Michael, I've gone really well with him. He said, look, I can show you the ropes of topping up your budget a bit. And I was away.
Christ.
But I'd obviously had lots of experience at school because if you read in the book, now I was heavily involved with the housemaster who abused quite a few of us. And he then got caught much later in life and is still in prison at this moment.
Oh,
so.
Wow. Well, I did read that.
I had some skills about what being a rent boy involved, so it wasn't all strange.
Christ. I mean, you talk about it quite, I'm going to say, there's so many double entendres here.
Go on.
Quite tongue-in-cheek now.
Yeah.
But I can imagine, the time that would have been a rather traumatic experience.
Well, it's how I was never hurt. So, maybe mentally, but I don't think so. I think I tried to use it to my advantage.
Well, clearly, because then you fast forward into doing racing professionally. And is finding the budget then becoming, is that as difficult? Or is it starting to come more readily?
No, it's not. Luckily, I had a reasonable name by the time I was really looking for drives all the time.
Yeah.
And so, no, it was, I never had to sort of drop to my knees and resort to Piccadilly again.
Great. Well, thank God for that.
Oh, I quite enjoyed it.
That's important as well,
I guess. There you go. John's lost for words.
Yes, this is incredible. Yes, it's going to be a unique podcast, I can tell.
It will. These are my favourites.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So then let's explore then that route into it. And once things started to, as you say, the requirements for the role got easier. I think there's a politically correct way of saying it, shall we say. How was that journey from that point onwards? Because, of course, motorsport today is so different, isn't it? If you want any high hopes of getting into F1, ideally your parents need to be multi-millionaires by the sounds of things.
Like,
you need to be...
Lando and Lance.
Yeah, absolutely.
That does help.
Yeah, well-heeled.
Yeah.
Can you remember what the what was it like back then in your era getting into that, and with the, I guess the target for everyone's always, I'd like to get into an F1 car.
Well, I just like racing, and I didn't have an ambition to be a Formula One driver. I thought if it presented itself, that'd be lovely, but sadly it didn't. Mm. Only because I was such a knob off the track. Well, pardon the pun. That I let myself down, and basically I love to party, still do. And I went for the Unipart drive with Nigel Mansell in 79 and with Dave Price, who was going to run. So it was going to be Brett Riley and hopefully me or Nigel Mansell. And Nigel got the deal. And years later, one of the blokes from hierarchy from Unipart, he said, do you know what, Fluxy, when you came for that interview with Nigel, he said, remember you'd let the fire extinguisher off over the snooker table in that posh hotel. He said, I couldn't justify to my board, who I told about this because you weren't anything to do with us then, oh, we've employed the bloke who's let the fire extinguisher off over the snooker table. So, I've made a great habit of shooting myself in the foot.
Jesus, yeah, clearly.
It's always important to be remembered, though, isn't it? So there you go. Whether you do that through sheer performance and impressiveness, or you do that because you happen to
John, yeah, and it's your job, there's no such thing as bad publicity.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
Well, yeah. I mean, exactly right. I think we are so used to now seeing, super media-trained sort of vanilla personalities, aren't we? That when somebody comes along that actually shakes the tree a little bit, we go, oh, that reminds us of,
how it used to be.
Yeah.
When people used to have fun.
Exactly. Tell us, those kind of romantic notions that we have of the 60s and 70s, everything, a bit careless, a bit rogue, drinking until late into the night before racing the next day.
Yeah.
Is that exactly how it was?
Absolutely. It was great fun. Everybody did it. Like, even up to when I was doing Tuscans in the 90s, TVR liked the camaraderie of us all and always stuck us in all of us in the same hotel that they were paying for. Mm. And so we'd all go on the piss. So you all turned up equal for qualifying, 10 pints and still on pole. Beat you.
I do like the idea of, perhaps being sat in a driver's briefing the following morning, looking around and just watching everyone like, oh, God.
Yeah.
They're absolutely hanging out. Yeah.
But I heard the other day that even British touring car mechanics now get breathalysed in the morning.
Is that right?
And you think, what the f*** is going on here? Yeah. The world's gone mad.
Well, yeah. Everything, I think, so people are so worried now, aren't they, about... something coming out in the media or whatever.
Yeah, thank God I've retired.
I was going to say, someone, to be brutally honest, someone like you now just wouldn't stand a chance, would you?
Well, my first experience of breathalysing stuff in racing, when I raced for three races in Japan in 93 in a BMW M3, and they were long races, so I had two Japanese teammates and me, and the Japanese teammates didn't drink. And you used to have to go to the doctors in the morning and piss in a bottle. Mm. And they do the test. And they just used to give me, they come out and give me their sample to go in with. Because they go, you never pass, Fluxy. Use ours.
It's amazing. Like you say, Miles, you look at, let's take Formula One as the example now. And there's been a lot of criticism, isn't there, over the past, I'd say even over the past 10 years or so, where the drivers, who, of course, the stars of the show, and Formula One has been glamorized through things like Netflix documentaries, and yet the true personalities, or certainly, actually, maybe wrong choice of words there, the represented personalities that are shown on the television shows or in the press conferences even, they are so robotic. There's just no personality to them.
And they must hate doing them, John.
Oh, God, absolutely.
You can see the look on their face and go, what a poxy question.
Surely,
I'll give it a poxy answer.
Absolutely. Absolutely, but then also not wanting to say the wrong thing in case they then get a tap on the shoulder from their sponsor going, we didn't actually like the way you answered that, so therefore we're going to have to pull our campaign. And it just you end up seeing these people who are just shells of their own personality giving answers.
I do like the old boy from Hess. I think he's about the only one
he's great.
I could go for a drink with and have a right laugh.
Yeah, he's great. He's brilliant. And I think there's even been suggestions of offshoots from the Drive to Survive for Gunther Steiner to have his own program, because he just tells us how it is, isn't he? Yeah. He's quite traditional.
I'd be quite happy, obviously not in Formula One, but if in my lives our paths had crossed and he'd be my team manager, I would have loved working with him.
I think you'd have been two peas in a pod.
Yeah. Just one more flux here and we must get off to bed. It's three. It'll be up at seven.
We've got qualified at eight.
Yeah.
So... I guess the bit that we haven't talked about yet is the business of driving, because you get into the cars.
Oh, that comes as second nature. Don't even have to think about it.
That's a great point you make, because some people find it, some people are, you know, trained into it. They receive a lot of training and can become great racing drivers. Would you describe yourself as a natural ability?
Yeah, I can jump into any, once I got to about 26, 27, I could just jump into anything without thinking at all, you know, just go in the right place. But what I was, that gave me a massive learning thing in my head about how a car should handle, because I didn't have to think about the driving or gear changing. So you could actually think, how can I improve this car? Because you didn't have that aspect to deal with.
Yes.
So, and that's where I became a well sought after test driver, because I could make people's cars by communicating with the right people, either the race engineer or the designer, and go, this is where we can improve, because I didn't have to think about the driving.
Surely. Mm. That's so valuable. That's so valuable in a team. That, you know, certainly from my experience as well, there are people that are blisteringly fast in the car, but they either don't know why they're fast or they don't really know how to feed back to the engineer about the car, which is just as important.
It is. And, you know, when you know you turn up on the grid... you're sitting on the start line and you know all the details that have gone into all the little bits, you know, unless you actually f*** up on the start, that you've probably won the race.
Yeah.
Because your car is that much better than your opposition.
That's really interesting.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And as you say, Miles, you know, certainly even in this modern era where so much is carried through data technology and, you know, telemetrics, and often there's the teams in the pit lanes that will be able to analyse what a car's doing, what the engine's doing.
Sorry to interrupt, that is such a valid point you just brought up, because the honesty of myself and the engineer, we didn't have all that. The privilege of being able to use that stuff, because it probably obviously would have helped, but... You know, the engineer or designer relied totally on me being honest with him and saying, if it was shit, it was shit. If it was great, it was great. You know, not everything works. Sometimes you have to go, well, that hasn't worked. Now they go, oh, well, data says this and the data says that.
That's right.
Absolutely right. And you're measured, you as a driver are measured to the nth degree.
Yeah, you can't lean, when you've over-revved the engine, you can't lean round as before you come down the pit lane and flick it back to zero and give it a rev and go, it's fine, as it's rattling away. Don't know what now.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about. That's fascinating. The part I'm also interested in is because actually we realise that we know a lot of people mutually, although we've never met before, so many people that we know have done certain series that were sort of billed to be the elite at the time, you know, like the TVR Tuscans. They were not, by all accounts, they were very, very powerful and very difficult cars to drive, but it's produced some fantastic racing drivers, and you were a big part of that.
It did. And really, the TVR Tuscan thing, although it came out in 1989, there's one race that set the whole TVR Tuscan challenge off, and that was 1993 at Donington. There was the shootout for touring cars, which Nigel was involved with, but Nigel also had a TVR dealership, or using his name, so Nigel was going to do the Tuscan race. And all of a sudden, the people who had been basically TVR dealers who had been racing all year suddenly thought, here's an opportunity to promote ourselves. We better get some pro drivers in. And sadly, Nigel didn't make the race because he'd fallen off in front of Tiff and hit the bridge, so off to hospital. So he did qualify, but not the race, sadly.
That's just, but, for avoidance of doubt, that's Tiff Nadell,
did he write the foreword of my book? I've forgotten.
His name is just at the very bottom of the book there.
He's an animated character himself, Tiff, isn't he? Yeah, so I can only imagine the two of you had a fair few escapades.
We did. We've raced all sorts of things against each other. He was my best man at my wedding.
Oh, lovely.
Probably why we got divorced. Not me and Tiff.
I was going to say, I didn't read that. Wow.
Yeah. But yeah, it's amazing just what one race, going back to what made the TVR Tuscan Challenge, it literally then just exploded. In 94, there was like 30 cars on the grid. 95, 40 cars. 96, best part of 50 cars were having to have two heats and a final because everybody was so...
Unheard of now.
And it really goes back to that one race. A bit like British touring cars was made popular in 1992 by the John Cleland-Steve Soper incident at Silverstone when Tim won the championship.
Yeah.
You know, that really put touring cars on the map.
Yeah. Yeah, that... if anyone's wondering what that moment is, go to YouTube now and have a look because it's fantastic. It's John Cleland and is it Tim Harvey?
No, Steve Soper.
Steve Soper, sorry. Steve in the BMW, of course.
Yeah.
And they have a coming together at Silverstone, right?
At Loughfield.
And
two laps to go.
With the onboard camera as well is absolutely fantastic. And the way that John Cleland leaps out of the
car. A man's a f***ing animal.
That interview is absolutely...
Good old Murray.
Is famous. It's brilliant. So go and have a look at that. But yeah, to your point... touring cars absolutely just exploded into life after that.
And much more in modern times, I might be speaking out of turn, but the last Grand Prix of 2021 with Lewis and Verstappen.
Oh, yeah?
You know, that probably helped Formula One no end for viewers the following year.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I think you're absolutely right. Everyone loves the bit of drama. They love to have a story to follow, don't they?
So yeah. I'm still waiting for the cigarette girls to come back.
Aren't we all?
They were the days.
I love that you remember obviously when the cigarette sponsors obviously disappeared, but then they were then finding all sorts of different ways to still sort of sponsor it, but not. If
that's
you know
right.
What I mean.
Yeah, because
they're still
on
the Ferrari, aren't they? To this day,
there's definitely a nod to it, isn't there? Because Ferrari got in trouble because of Marlborough, who put the barcode from the cigarette packet,
which
I thought was just genius.
Like,
we're not saying cigarettes at all. There's not even a reference to cigarettes, but it just so happens that series of white stripes on our back spoiler is the barcode from the back of a packet of Marlborough.
Even on the front of my book, I still give the nod to cigarettes because Embassy of Cigarettes.
Brilliant. Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah.
But not the one I've got in my hand, obviously. I don't smoke them anymore. I've always smoked Marlboro Gold.
So Marlboro Gold, if you're listening, Ian was open to sponsorship deals.
Yeah.
Love it. So Ian, tell us a little bit about some of those rogue stories that possibly didn't make it in to the book, because I can imagine there had to be some sanitisation before it went to print.
Yes, and actually, to sort of aid with that question as well. So has it been co-authored, or you've had somebody who's
Matt wrote it. So it's all my words. So there's 29 hours of on your laptop talking.
I'd like to explore that. I can imagine the process of Matt sits you down. The two of you are perhaps in a room going right.
No, we always did it in the pub.
Perfect, even better.
You can tell, we normally start at about 3:30, and you can tell by 6 o'clock how much more animated and how much more swearings crept into it.
So yeah,
and then we used to stop at 8:00.
So what we want is the stories that made Matt go, we probably aren't going to put that one in.
Yeah.
Let's go for
actually, the most
the
popular, no, there's a great story in the book which people have cottoned onto, but I won't spoil that. But with the cigarette girls in the 70s when I was working for Graham Hill, there were Embassy girls, Marlboro girls, JPS girls, and they used to bung us all in the same hotel. And obviously the girls would prefer a Formula One driver, but you know, a Formula One mechanic, as far as we were concerned, was the next best option because there was more of us than there were drivers. So the hotels were a riot, absolute riot.
I can imagine.
And, you know, I was 18 and 19 then.
Yeah.
So...
I feel like I've lived such a sheltered life.
No, you have.
Yeah. I certainly feel like perhaps we were born in the wrong era.
I say this often.
Many times.
Honestly, John, I just think I was so lucky that Mum and Dad shagged when they did, because I couldn't do it. I couldn't do what I've done at Miles' age now.
No. No, indeed.
He'd be in serious trouble.
Well, I think I'd be in hospital, probably. On an IV trip.
Yeah. Sorry, I've got some KY with me. You'll
be
right.
God! Oh, God!
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, yeah, for a bit of context, the book appeared, or you started to record it in 2019. Is that
no,
right?
No, I retired in 2019.
It was 21.
Yeah, we started, the first day was April the 7th, 2021.
And how did the idea come about? Because, you know, presumably you didn't, did you go, I want to write a book?
No. I've talked about it for years, but absolutely jack about it. And my son's always been, Dad, you should really write a book.
Yeah.
And then out of the blue, Eric Vernerowe, who is Evro Publishing,
yes,
rang me. And I didn't even believe it was him. I had to ring him back because I thought it was a mate taking the piss, who's great at voiceovers. And it was true. And when the first bit of money arrived, I realised it was really true.
Awesome.
Oh, and a contract as well.
Well, that's always when it's in writing.
Yeah, but I did like the money here in the bank. That really gave it, oh, your God, this is happening.
Yeah. So over the course of, what, 18 months or so?
Yeah, we got it all. Sadly, because Matt James is also the editor of Motorsport News, and he has to get that out on a Monday to be out in the shops on Wednesday. Sorry, online. He was really busy, short-staffed, and we actually got it all finished for October last year.
Yeah.
But Eric said, we've missed the Christmas opportunity. We're just going to have to put it on hold. So it took us 18 months to do it, basically. Mm. But we've didn't release it to June this year because Eric said, you know, they're publishers. I'm not.
They know the business.
I know what time the last bell is in the pub. I don't know anything else much these days. Sometimes I forget that and it's 4 a.m.
Depends how friendly the landlord is.
Oh, very. If you're ever in Newport Pagnell, come to the Dove. It's just behind Newport Pagnell Services.
First drinks on Ian.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. After you bought a book.
we'll start talking once you've bought a copy.
It must be, I'm always excited to talk to people that have written books, especially with such flourishing and varied careers, because it must unlock so many memories. You must have got to a point where you sat there going, oh my God, I'd absolutely forgotten about this.
Yeah, and you're so right, the jerking of that, oh my God, and this, God, I missed that.
Yeah.
Oh, can we go back? I've just thought of something else.
Yeah, of course. Have you had many, since the book's been completed and published, that you've then thought, oh, my God, I've missed a complete...
Well, yeah, I honestly have. I mean, I really think with what was on the cutting room floor and what I've remembered, should it ever be wanted to be done, I think a volume two would be a lot easier to do than volume one.
Suddenly, everyone that has escaped...
Has breathed a sigh of relief.
Yeah, has just gone, oh, no. Oh, no, there's another one coming.
Also, I was very, very lucky, just thought of this one, John just reminded me, you know, to work for two world champions who were known around the world, Graham Hill and Giacomo Agostini. You don't realise at the time, but you're obviously a bit of a sponge, and you see particularly how humorous Graham was and how elegant and gentlemanly and courteous that Ago was, that I think in your subconscious you do take that on board at that age and go, you know, oh God, you know, you weren't 3 times world champion and 11 or 12 times what Ago was without being brilliant at what you're doing.
Yes.
But to carry, like when I worked for Ago, he came to cars and was in a Williams FW06 and we ran him with Ian Dyer, who was Senna's mechanic, in the British series in 79. And Marlborough, basically, because of he won their first ever championship, I think, in 77 for Yamaha, he had Marlborough backing for the rest of his life, as long as he wanted it. Mm. You know, it was only cigarettes being banned that Ago would still be having his own team running Marlborough today.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And to be thought that highly of, yeah, don't worry about the money. We'll just keep supplying it.
It's amazing. I mean, you can't imagine any sort of like gentlemen's agreements like that going on these days without there being 16 contracts and 10 lawyers per contract all wanting to get their say in how it all works.
Just a nice little touch about Ago. So we were at Alton Park on a test day and some kids came over. It must have been a half term or something. One of them had a little Italia jet, mini scrambler type thing. Yeah. And his dad must have said in the background, there's Agostini over there. I'll stay over here and you and your mate go over. And so he came over and said, oh, you know, can I have your autograph? And so he signed the tank and then he sat on this kid's bike. Unbeknownst, we're all chatting and carrying about and having a sandwich and everything. Anyway, Ian Dyer nudged me and he went, Ago has not put his foot down. He's sat on that bike with his feet on the pegs for like 10 minutes. Just chatting away. Bars turned a bit. So after the kid went and Ago went, we called the kid back and said, and like we had a go, and like we managed 8 seconds or 12 seconds and Ago had sat on it for 10 minutes.
Wow.
Just holding a conversation. Just
balancing away.
That's unbelievable. There's a few names that you've mentioned which I'm keen to talk about because they are so big, you know, and we talk about the Formula One era and obviously Graham Hill, somebody like that, you know, I think we still hold in such high esteem. Was the man how we perceived him to be?
Yes, for me, but no for the mechanics. He did make the mechanics' life hell. We used to have a team meeting on a Tuesday when the truck normally got back from the previous Grand Prix. Graham would arrive in the afternoon and there'd be a job list compiled. And in those days, there was it was a full-time job. No, you didn't. Once the season started, it was 7 days a week.
Wow.
You were free once the truck went and then you flew the next morning, but that was it. So you work all weekend and then next time you see Graham was like on the Wednesday before the truck was leaving on the Thursday.
Yeah.
And he said to the mechanics, like, what's this? And go, well, this is the bit on the job list. Oh, I didn't mean do it like that. And, you know, they'd end up working all night to... No, he was quite cantankerous with them, but he didn't affect me because obviously I was only the junior and, I just heard them muttering after he'd gone.
Okay, so let's fast forward to some cars as well that we know and celebrate to be very, very famous, like the Jaguar, like the XJR15. Etc. These Group C cars that we still know to be monsters of the day.
Yeah.
You spent a lot of time in those, right?
I did. I was very lucky, but I was absolutely moved last year. The McLaren F1 GTR won the British GT Championship in 96.
Yeah.
It was owned by a guy called Jake Ulrich, who I shared the driving with. And he put that car into mothballs at the end of October 1996. And Jacob paid $400,000 for it at the start of the season, secondhand from Ray Belm. Jake then sold it in June 2013 to, I think, Aaron Soh for $8.5 million. Aaron then moved it on. Anyway, I got a phone call from a guy called Greg last April. He said, oh, I know the guy who's bought your McLaren. He would absolutely love if you could come down and sit in it. Can you bring some ovals, trophies, reminisce? And he'd like to... So I took Lucy down with me and sat in it and jokingly said, can I fire it up? And he said, yeah. Go, vroom, remembered how to do it. And just sitting in it with it running, and like you're just overcome with, I didn't think you could be like that about a car. Mm. Or I was kicking myself with emotion because I'd found out he'd just paid $22 million for it. Thought, if I'd had been on 1% when I drove for Jake rather than a grand a day, I would be considerably better off.
Yeah, wow. It's amazing. I mean, it's so true, isn't it? I think to the non-petrol head, the non-car person, and we're fortunate that I think almost every single person that's going to be listening to this podcast is somebody that can associate with the emotional connection with cars, which non-motoring people just don't get, do they? It's a bizarre concept that we can have any sort of emotional attachment, or the sound of a, or the startup procedure of an engine might trigger some sort of emotional memory. But this is one of the things I love talking to. And in fact, a few weeks ago, Miles and I were wandering around at Goodwood and talking to the likes of Jackie Ickx and some of the older drivers. Derek Bell is somebody I've been very fortunate to do lots of work with over the years. And always hearing people like Jackie and Derek talking about the cars that they drove and then being reunited with them at events like the Goodwood Revival or the Festival of Speed, and hearing them almost turn back into a 22-year-old again.
Well, like I said about the front cover of my book, you know, to be reunited, well, not reunited because I only ever worked on it, I was only 19, but to then get the privilege of driving that car that it was right at the start of your career.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and that, and you know, like you say, it's the start of your career. You don't at that point really know where it's going or where it's headed.
Well, sadly, none of us do we?
No, of course you don't.
You can have a road accident on the way home.
Well, yeah, precisely that, and you know, so many, you know, we've spoken, like I said before we started recording, we've spoken to so many racing drivers over the years. You know, Martin Donnelly as well tells a fantastic story. Obviously, his career cut short by.
Yeah, but he should be dead. You know, that, the size of that accident. And, you know, when you see it again, I mean, I remember watching it at the time.
Yeah.
But when you keep seeing it, you see it again now, you think, oh my God, how's he still alive?
For sure. Yeah. And he doesn't shy away from that at all, does he? He's like, no, I really shouldn't be here.
Do you want a quick Martin Donnelly story?
Always.
Absolutely.
So in 2006, Mazda approached. I'd raced for them in 2005. It was the first time there was a 24-hour race at Silverstone. Mm. So I'd raced for Mazda then. And then next year, all of a sudden, Martin's involved as well. Anyway, so he rang me up and he said, oh, Fluxy, what did you get last year? I said, $2,000 and a pair of new overalls. And he said, well, we're not having that. He said, that's pathetic. Leave that to me. Anyway, he got us $7,000. Obviously, I had to give him $1,000 for his negotiation. It was obviously worth it.
Not one to be left out of a deal with Donnelly. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, and the reason why I bring that up is because there have been particular highlights of your career. 5 championships doesn't happen by accident, not one bit. What do you think was the ticket to you? Clearly, you've got some driving ability.
Being in the right car and the right day. And
do you think that's a big part of it?
Yeah. But obviously, there's one day that absolutely stands out in my life above all others. Obviously, working with Graham Hill, I've known Damon since he was 15. October the 13th, 1996, we got up as a family to cheer Damon on winning Japan and the Formula One Championship. Took the kids to the grandparents, went back to Silverstone and raced. At 2:30, I became the British GT champion in the McLaren. And at 4:00, I became the TVR Tuscan champion. And that was all one day. And you think...
On the same day?
All on October the 13th.
Come on.
Wow. That's amazing.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Into. I mean, the F1... You're talking about the F1 GTR.
Yeah.
That's a car that has certainly escaped me and many others because it's the rocking horse car, isn't it? Driving it in period in the British GT.
And winning
is huge. Absolutely huge. I can imagine, in fact, well, tell us, what was the call like to say, Ian, this is happening, you're going to be in the seat of that car this season?
It was all predestined because... Jake Ulrich came over from America and did TVR Tuscans. He needed a driver coach. And I was recommended by James, come on, sorry.
That's right.
And so I coached Jake in the whole of 1995.
Got it.
He said he wanted to progress to GT, so we were a good, strong team by then. Mm. And we looked at various cars. I knew Paul Lanzanti really well from days of old. Yeah. And obviously, Paul's organisation had won Le Mans for McLaren in 95. Mm. And I said to Jake, you know, this is really a no-brainer that I know Paul, he's won Le Mans, he's got all the right people. He's told me Ray Belm's selling both his cars because he's replacing them with brand new ones. You know, let's just go down and pick which one you want.
Amazing. I think it's worth pointing out as well. So we get an amazing variance of age listeners to our podcast, and yeah,
I'm only 12.
Yeah,
got a whole life in front of me.
Just be a tough paper round it. Yeah.
But yeah, I always like to remind people, especially for the benefit of our younger listeners, who, when they think of McLaren as a brand now, they think of very fast road cars. But for an awful long time, it wasn't really until like the early 2000s or beyond. I'm trying to think where the MP4 12
season.
2012. So prior to 2012, McLaren made racing cars exclusively. Yeah. That was it.
Yeah.
And they did put an F1 on the road. So early 1990s, the McLaren F1 did go on as a road car. But that was an absolute, like, one in a million chance that this racing car manufacturer had produced a car
that's so valuable because the whole project failed.
Well, that's it.
They wanted to sell 350 road cars.
Yeah.
That was all based around.
Yeah.
And they sold 44.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It's, take us back then to that time. And I mean, we look at the car now, the F1, both the road car F1 and the F1 GTR, as just, they are absolute halo cars now. And as you say, the values of them have gone through the roof. And I think I'm right in saying that the designer himself, and Gordon Murray, has ended up having to sell his car because it's simply just uneconomical to insure it these days, because they're all worth about 20 million quid.
Minimum.
Yeah, absolutely. Did it, to you as a driver in that era, did it feel so much better than anything else?
No, it was a pile of shit.
Really?
I told Ron Dennis that in 1995 I was the Motor and News track tester for 10 years, and I got invited to test the Harrods one after Le Mans.
Yes.
At Silverstone Grand Prix Circuit. Well, in the morning I'd been there in my Tuscan because we had a race coming up. And so the McLaren was 625 grand, a Tuscan was 25 grand or 28 grand. And I was only 2 seconds quicker in the McLaren on the same day, on the same track, than I was in the McLaren. So in the report, I put, how can Ron Dennis justify for 2 seconds it's an extra 600 grand and got myself in more...
I bet he loved that.
But, you know, honest feedback. You've got to accept it.
That's really interesting. I was actually, funnily enough, I was listening to a podcast with Dave Clark only the other day.
Yeah, because you know he's really bad, don't you?
No.
Dave Clark from McLaren?
Dave, yeah.
He's really ill.
Is he?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
He had a tumour.
Oh, what a shame.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't aware of that.
Couldn't walk and couldn't talk.
Oh, wow.
And this is 3 months ago.
Christ.
Oh, wow.
Well, our thoughts go out to Mr. Clark.
Mm.
Absolutely, but he talks very fondly of those,
as he would, because he sold his Harrods one for 32 million.
He did all right. Wow. He did all right. But to your point, yeah, they had aspirations to sell lots of road cars, and it just didn't happen. But like you say, that car, actually, when it comes down to driving it as a race car, it just didn't really work, did it?
No, the worst thing about the one I raced was we had an engine was great,
yeah,
but it had an old fashioned H pattern gearbox, and it was as slow as a like Porsche 956. That was always slow as well. But for the new cars, the long tail ones, they put a sequential box in it, and that was so much better to drive, especially in the wet.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing hearing that side of it, because I think it is such a halo car that vast majority of people that have been perhaps only lucky enough to see one from afar or stand next to one have these romantic visions of it just must be such a magical thing to drive. So to hear someone like yourself go, well, actually, not as good as you might think. It's that's really interesting. That's fascinating. There must be some cars though that do stand out as cars that you perhaps got into, and then for the first time, that first few laps, you thought, my God, this thing is just a cut above the rest.
I've got a good touching story along those lines. So for years, I tested for Harry Leventis the Aston Martin DBR1 that won Le Mans. I've driven it like 15, 16 times, but never raced. I only tested it because the team liked my feedback. Anyway, so this is... think 2013. Anyway, it was end of August, and obviously the revival, as you were there last weekend, takes place. And they rang up and said, oh, we've got a gearbox and diff to run in at Mallory, which is where we always used to go on a Wednesday morning.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, bowled round for 50-odd laps running and came in and said, right, OK. Then Tim Samways, who ran the operation, said, right, go and give it five proper laps. And always five proper laps in that was somewhere in the 48s, as long as it was either 48.1 or 48.9, depending on the traffic. Anyway, I came in after doing a few 48s and said it was all good. And he said, did you enjoy that, Flaxy? And I said, Tim, what's wrong? I've driven for you for 12 years. I've tested this car God knows how many times. Why did you ask me that? And he said, well, we didn't want to tell you, but Harry sold the car on Monday for £21 million. And when I asked you to do make sure it was all right and do the 48s, we didn't want to put that pressure on your shoulders because you wouldn't have slung it around like you just have.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, and he's probably right, isn't he?
He's probably right.
Yeah, even I've got a degree of responsibility. I like to keep my reasonable reputation on the track intact.
I don't believe you for a minute.
I find the conversation about mechanical sympathy with racing drivers a really interesting one because it's always a diverse reaction. There are some that I find, and it's often the ones you don't expect, are the most sympathetic to the value of a car or, of course, the mechanical sympathy and making sure the car is going to get through an endurance race. And you speak to others who are just like, no, I'm there to do my job. If the car fails, then that's not my fault. So where do you sit in that?
Well, I've taught myself mechanical sympathy and accidents because I lived on prize money from 1974 to 2000 when it was all stopped.
Wow, yeah.
And even if you were coming fifth and getting 100 quid, bearing in mind you're talking 80s, late 80s.
Went a long way.
Yeah, a couple of school days with Ian Taylor, 200 quid a day, an extra 100 quid. Yeah, you were still having a great life on 500 quid.
You were making a career
so
out of it.
Everything about my racing was get it to the finish. Okay, if there's a championship and it's the last corner on the last lap and it's the difference between winning it or not,
yes.
Okay, you know, take the person out or crash it, but at least have a go. But other than that, you know, I want you get points, the car's in one bit if you finish, and you get prize money that helps you live. Because you used to get a basic allowance for fuel and hotels or travelling, but then I get 50% of all the prize money.
Perfect, yeah. Fascinating. So, of course, if the car doesn't survive, then you don't get your
money.
Yeah,
and prize money literally was first to sixth. Well, obviously, there was more for first, second and third. So you always wanted to be on the rostrum.
Mm.
So if you're on the rostrum, the car's in one bit because you finished and you get some money.
Wow.
And the prize money was always good. Like in Tuscans, if I had a clean-up weekend, I'd get 600 quid on top of my 250 quid travelling and hotel.
That'd probably just about cover the beer tab, would it?
Oh, no, somebody else would buy that. I'm always very great. I'm very good at delegating who's round it is.
Hang on. Write that down.
And it's yours, Miles.
Don't go drinking with Ian.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, drinking what was the name story of that pub to avoid? You So this is 1998. And Richard Hay, I'm sure you've dealt with Richard over the years, make all the films, Hay Fisher Productions.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
Anyway, Richard rings up and he said, oh, Fluxy, I think you'll make a good commentator. We'd like to give you a try. So he said, come up to the... We had a race at the Tuscan race at Snetterton, and my car caught fire, so I wasn't in it. So he said, come up and commentate on that, because you know, you'll tell us what you were missing. And anyway, so... when I get there, he said, oh, first of all, we're running a bit late and this bloke hasn't turned out. We've got a stock car race to commentate on from Brayfield. I said, well, I know nothing about it. He said, oh, here's the programme, look at some numbers. And I was absolutely rubbish. And anyway, they said, oh, that was great, that's great. I said, well, I'm sure it wasn't, but, you know, there's the red car. Oh, green car, who's driving? What's his name?
Yeah,
losing the plot completely. Yeah. Anyway, they said, well, to celebrate how well you've done there, let's have a few beers. So there was some cans of Stella in the fridge, and about three cans of Stella. And while we're up, almost finishing this, and I'm thinking I'm going to go, I have Matt James with us as well. And Richard said, oh, just for a laugh, Flaxy, why don't you do a proper commentary on that Snetterton Tuscan race? Say what you f***ing like. Anyway, so... there's Bobby Vernon Rose on pole, and my opening line is, there's that cheating Bobby Vernon Rose with his oversized works engine. Anyway, never gave it another thought. So did this commentary. Never gave it a thought. We all had a good laugh. Fast forward to November, it's the TVR Tuscan prize giving at the Metropole in Birmingham. No. Anyway, so they normally have something a bit different. And I said to Ben Samuelson, the PR guy, oh, what's happening this year, Ben? I haven't heard much about, you know, what's the attraction, and have we got a new comedian or something? He said, oh, yeah, it's all sorted out, Frank, so you'll see when it happens. Anyway, so Ben stands up, you know, after everybody's had a few drinks and dinner. He said, oh, we've got something different for you this year, ladies and gentlemen. It's a bit below the belt. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to play a minute of it, and if you don't like it, we won't play any more. But if you do, you can have the rest.
Great.
And I thought, this.
This will be good.
Yeah. So the screen music. And the first thing that I heard, there's that cheating Bobby Verdon. And so they did a minute and shut it down. And Ben said, right, who wants to hear the rest? And without exception, everyone, yes.
Brilliant. Oh,
and I
God.
Rubbished every driver in that race.
Oh, brilliant.
We have to find that tape.
Yeah. I've got it.
Have you really?
Yeah.
Oh, amazing.
That's yeah, I'm not surprised by any of that, I have to say. I think at this point we'll go. Well, I need to go and have a lie down. And,
are we going to the toilets together?
Yes, definitely not. No, I'm going to go first.
There's plenty of room in there, Miles.
No, there definitely isn't.
I don't know what the problem is. So, Ian, I feel like there's an awful lot of stories that we're not going to hear in this, you know, the time that we've got together. And of course, that's always the way when we get restricted time. But it's probably an important time that we direct our dear listener to the book, because I think we've just scratched the surface on some of the stories.
Yes,
that,
we have. And hopefully it's given everybody a small appetizer as to how much fun is in the book. And I'm so grateful for the people who've already magazines and things that have received it, and the feedback and the promotion of I'm shocked for words that how lovely people have been about it.
That's brilliant. Oh, that is brilliant. Well, you can find the details of where to get the book. Don't worry, we're not wrapping up just yet, but I thought I'd mention it now just in case people have heard enough to go, I need to get this ordered. So yeah, scroll down to the show notes. You'll see there some links through to where you can find the book. I can't wait to have a read myself. I think it's going to be absolutely
one
wild.
Thing I've learned, which I didn't have a clue about, is about how books are sold.
Yeah.
And so I asked Eric Verdon Rowe how things are going. He said, it's very difficult to tell, Flux. I'm like, well, how's it difficult to tell? He said, well, Amazon work for 120 days behind.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah, 120 days.
Wow. I learned a good fact, which is one for you. You can keep this one as a freebie. If you ever get the opportunity to write a book, which you have, and you ever get the opportunity to do a book signing in a bookshop, this is the crucial bit. Usually you get invited in about an hour or so before the crowds turn up, and you get the opportunity to pre-sign a few books. The top tip is sign as many as you can. All of them. Just scribble your name in every single one. Do you know why?
No.
Because a signed book is a sold book. Guaranteed.
Oh, fantastic.
They can't send the signed books back.
Yeah.
So if you get that call, get them half an hour early.
Oh, there you go.
And just scribbling everything. And they're all sold.
I feel like Ian's going to employ like 20 people to come and write a signature in the books now.
Too right.
Yeah. I
love that fact.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's paid for my petrol getting it.
Too easy. That's brilliant. So Ian, in the blurb on the back, there's a suggestion that there was a lot of high points in the racing, but then there were some setbacks as well and some darker parts. Anything you're keen to talk about?
Well, I think basically the setbacks were, you know, done by me. I can remember a British Grand Prix support race in 1987 at Silverstone, Brands. Or 86, I qualified on the front row with a car that shouldn't have been on the front row. So celebrating that fact. Then I got approached in the Kentigan by Tech Speed, Gil Baird, who owned Tech Speed, and he said, look, Fluxy, with that sort of performance, we want to put you in a Formula 3. There's a new series coming out for British Formula 3000 next year. Don't have to bring any money. Turn up and we'll share the prize money. Anyway, so I now started to need to celebrate that on top of my front row. So I was absolutely bollocks about 11 o'clock, and it was a hot night, and the Kentigan doors were open at Brands, and I tripped over the step, and I landed at the Tech Speed team manager's feet, Marvin Humphreys.
Oh, no.
And he went, that's the end of that drive then, Fluxy. We can't have you like that.
No way.
Oh, wow.
So I did British Formula 3000 for best part of an hour and a half.
Oh, gosh. Wow.
So that's got to be a record for short-lived career. Well,
I was also the youngest and shortest ever board member on the BRD, a director of the BRDC. I was 36 when I was the director. Wow. And I think I was on it for 14 months before we all got kicked off the board for giving Tom Walkinshaw £5.7 million of the club funds without asking anybody.
Oh, God. Are you kidding?
I had to go to the High Court 3 times. Because I was a director. That's why I'll never be a director of anything. I only joined the BRDC board of directors so I can get some extra passes I could flog for the British Grand Prix.
Brilliant.
But I didn't think I was going to end up in court and possibly losing my house over it, because if we lost the case, we, as directors, you're responsible.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But as it turned out, what had happened, Tom had got the accountants to write 2 different... What are they called?
Some due diligence or whatever.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. Due diligence.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, there was the copy the directors received, which we read and which we voted on. And then there was the real one.
Oh, God.
Which said, this is a really bad idea, but we never saw that.
Wow. Yeah.
I dread to think how many deals like that were done back in the day.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's actually, funnily enough, that's something I wanted to ask, because I'm, again, always fascinated in the modern era of motorsport and, yeah, the various stages that we have to go through with sponsorship and appraisals and this, that and the other. I've heard some fantastic stories.
You mean all that bollocks?
Exactly that, yeah, all that bollocks. How involved did you ever get as a driver with things like sponsorship deals and like with the fee negotiation? You get that great story about Donnelly, you know, renegotiating things for you, which I think in the modern era just wouldn't happen anymore. I can't imagine Lewis Hamilton meeting somebody in the pub who's got a particular brand and going, all right, I'll get you on the side of my car.
Well, obviously going back to 1978, I got very close up close with the sponsorship proposals.
You could say that, yeah. You could say that. When we talk, yeah. We talk about getting...
Couldn't get any closer. I think that was intimate.
Good grief. That was Flux's version of due diligence.
Yeah.
Gross.
Well, I hope it paid off.
Well, it did. It got a few sets of tyres.
Oh, God, yeah. Well, but yeah, to John's point.
And
yeah.
I love going to swinging clubs now.
Perfect.
Keep throwing me off here, Ian. Yeah, no, exactly. Like you say, things are done extremely differently now to what they were.
I can remember Shell at the end, won the British Formula V Championship in 1975, and Shell wanted to continue sponsoring me in 1976. And it must have been October, and I took the contract in because I knew Graham Hill was coming in on the Tuesday. Mm. So I took the contract in and I said, Graham, if you've got 5 minutes at some point of the day, could you just look over that for me? Mm-hmm. Anyway, he taps on the window and called me up to the office. And he said, I'm just going to show you where to sign this. And he went, chucked it in the bin. He said, you were just about to sign your life away. He said, you don't need a contract. If you're good enough, they want you to race for you. If they're bad, they'll get rid of you. It's not complicated.
Wow. Yeah. Again, don't see that in modern-day motorsport, do you?
It's just such a polar opposite now. Yeah. Such a polar opposite, yeah. Talk to us about, you know, for someone like yourself who's driven actually so many different cars.
600 over.
Wow. 600 different race cars.
Yeah.
I can't think of many people that could possibly even achieve that.
Marcus Pye is pretty close.
Marcus Pye?
Yeah, because of obviously all the autosport tests he did.
Yes, of course. 600 race cars. Is there anything that... Was there a car that stuck out to you that you... If somebody said...
Yeah.
Ian, you can get back into this car and race it now. What would it be?
I was lucky enough to drive Schumacher's 2004 winning Ferrari at Donington on a test day.
Wow.
Martin, it was owned privately by Paul Osborne, who's a long-time mate, whose company's Cars International. And Sky had hired it for Martin Brundle to do a lunchtime session, which Martin obviously did. And I was working for Radical that day. I think it was 2011 or 12. And about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Paul appeared in our garage and said, do you fancy a go, Fluxy?
Wow.
I went, are you joking? He said, mate, I wouldn't have wandered down here to try and find you if I was bloody joking.
Come on.
So I said to the Radical boys, I think I better go and do this.
Yeah.
And Paul said, right, the only deal is We'll alter the belts for you, but we're not mucking about with anything else. Either you fit in Brundle's seat or you don't.
Sure.
And all they had to do was just slightly shorten the crutch belt an inch, and I was ready to go, obviously. Wow. And so I fired it up, and then he went, so I turned it off, and he leant in and he said, "Flaxy, you know you can't afford to fix it if you crash it, so don't crash, off you go."
Brilliant, no pressure.
No. So he said, "Go out and do 10 laps, and I did 8, and I was just over a second away, on the same set of tyres, a second and a half away from what Brundle had done on the lunch hour, and I was out of traffic as well.
Gosh.
And I could do that. I did that with no trouble whatsoever. And I came in because I thought, when they put the board up, I thought, well, it's only 1.5 seconds slower than Brundle. And I thought, as I went down to Redgate, I said, "No, just call it a day."
Yeah.
Because you're actually going to have to start trying now.
Surely, yeah.
And
yeah.
If you start trying, there's going to be an accident. So just come in. And Paul said, there was 2 more laps to go. I said, "You said don't crash yet." And I said, "I did that effortlessly. But
brilliant.
I know I can find the other bit, but your car was going to be a bit more ragged."
What an experience.
And what a nice metaphor to end with. It's always important, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, to know when to call it a day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I always do when I bring the tissues out.
And that moment, ladies and gentlemen, is now.
Oh, you meant for something else. I meant for the tears. You're mine.
Stop it.
Well, Ian, thank you. Thank you for so generously giving us so much of your unfiltered approach to life and the stories. And it is, as I say, fascinating. I feel like we've only scratched the surface. If we were going through pages in the book, I think we've probably only done about 10 pages.
Yeah.
So I can imagine that the bits we haven't read, and heaven forbid, the bits that did make that cutting room floor, God can only hope they never see the light of day.
Or volume two.
Or volume two. The only way to do it is get the first one bought and then write to the publishers saying, "We want more."
Well, I really hope some of your listeners will be doing that for me. It's been great fun. I've really enjoyed it. And may I just say a massive big thank you to Sam Holman, who I wouldn't be sitting here if it wasn't for Sam and his friendship with Miles and meeting John. Thank you both.
Brilliant.
Very kind of you to say. Thank you, Ian. It's been brilliant having you on. I think we both very much look forward to actually sharing a beer with you at some point.
Yeah, that'd be
and
great.
Obviously picking up the tab. And yes, thank you to Sam for making the introduction. You wouldn't be sat here without him.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, dear listener. As ever, if you want to see everything that we do, head on over to the website driven.site, where you'll see our entire back catalogue of all the episodes that we've recorded so far, as well as all the written articles we have and the news stories that we handpick for you. If you are joining us for the first time, don't forget to subscribe. We have got now approaching 180 of these episodes that you can enjoy. So go back, have a look through at the conversations. In fact, some of the names that we have mentioned in this episode we have had podcasts with, such as Steve Soper. Go and search it out, because there are some fantastic stories in there with the conversation I had with Steve a year or so ago. For now, that leaves us to say a massive thank you. Thank you, Miles.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you very much, John.
Pleasure, 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 pleasure. And thank you, dear listener. We look forward to bringing you more of the same, perhaps with slightly more family-friendly language next week.
Well, and also, if this is indeed the last episode because we've been cancelled, then it's been very much fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I hope that's not the case. I will be forever guilty.
Not at all. Not at all. Thank you both.
The Driven Chat Podcast, powered by Paramex Digital.
Oh, wow. You've made it to the end, the very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven podcast in your preferred podcast app, or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.